turban and be fully searched. There was no way Karzai could honorably ask Afghan leaders to subject themselves to such a search. He fulminated and fumed to Crocker and the White House. In the end, Obama stayed 6 hours in Kabul under cover of darkness, flying by helicopter from Bagram to the Arg for a brief one-on-one with Karzai before they signed at midnight. The president seemed distant and distracted. Karzai offered him tea or coffee, but Obama refused, an insulting breach of local protocol, as the president surely knew by now. In a televised speech from Bagram, Obama acknowledged more directly than ever before his administration's secret talks with the Taliban, and he spoke of a future in which war ends and a new chapter begins. That spring, Kayani announced that Ahmad Shuja Pasha would retire as ISI chief, 3.5 years after he took charge. Kayani named General Zahir ul Islam as Pasha's successor. Islam was a Punjabi whose father had been a brigadier in the Pakistan Army. His most notable physical feature was an impressively bushy mustache. He had most recently served as the powerful corps commander in Karachi. Earlier, he had done a tour as an officer in the ISI section that manipulated domestic politics. Pasha moved to Abu Dhabi to enroll his son in school there. Barnett Rubin flew to Islamabad to try to understand Pakistan's position after the breakdown with Tayyab Aga. He met twice over the next few months with Major General Sahibzada Pataudi, the ISI Director of Analysis, as well as his deputy Brigadier Salim Kamar Bhutt, who ran the desk that analyzed the United States. For the first meeting, Rubin rode to ISI headquarters with an embassy note-taker. The second time, they agreed to speak more informally. Pataudi served lunch. They agreed that they were talking as individuals, not negotiating for their governments. "We don't want to be a spoiler, and we don't want the Taliban breathing down our necks for some spite that was never intended," Pataudi said. "We need to see a process out in the open that we can rely on. We can't guarantee anything." Rubin asked Pataudi what he thought the Taliban's negotiating position would be if they got that far. The ISI general said he thought the Taliban had matured while in exile. They had started as young kids just out of the madrasas, eager to kill. When they started to govern, they imposed a tough version of Sharia, and people are afraid that will happen again. Yet over the past 10 years of exposure to Pakistan, the international community, traveling to Saudi Arabia and the smaller Gulf states, many Taliban leaders had developed a different worldview. "Look at the new stuff, the idea of women soldiers," Pataudi said. "It all seeps in." "Pakistan's worst fear," he went on, "was another civil war in Afghanistan. More drugs pouring into Pakistan, more guns, more warlords. We'd like to fence the border." The Taliban were on the ascendance, Pataudi believed. The only incentive that might work would be to offer the Taliban a share of political power through a transparent process, after adequate confidence-building measures. Rubin and Chris Kolenda at the Pentagon co-authored a new classified strategy document. The paper outlined a regional framework, one that could be a basis for negotiations with the Taliban, Pakistan, Karzai, and other Afghan groups, as well as neighboring governments such as China and Iran. Luton Lavoie agreed that leveraging China's influence over Pakistan could be helpful, even decisive, in developing a durable peace plan, although the idea of involving Iran looked too complicated, given the separate track of nuclear negotiations underway. It was hard for Rubin to inventory how many papers of this ilk he had written or co-written since arriving at the State Department in 2009. He had never had faith in his government's ability to use its power constructively in Afghanistan, but now his enthusiasm about trying had started to wane. The obstacles seemed so great. One afternoon that autumn, Rubin arrived at one of the White House visitor gates for a meeting of the conflict resolution cell that had been called to discuss his latest paper. Reuben had a top-secret security clearance and was typically cleared into the Eisenhower Executive Office Building without incident. But a guard pulled him aside and said that he would require an escort. The guard called Lute's office but couldn't find anyone. "Fed up," Reuben told the officer. "It's okay. If I'm too dangerous to national security to discuss my own paper, I'll leave." He went back to his office at State. Jeff Eggers, Lute's deputy, soon called him, asked him to return, and apologized. Reuben noted that this had been happening to him throughout his time in government, but only when he visited the White House. It was a running joke among them. No Taliban in the White House. Lute asked the Secret Service what was really going on. They told him they couldn't disclose the answer due to privacy laws. "Look, if it's because he has contact with some dubious people, and he has phone calls with some dangerous people, he's doing that for us." "No," the reply came. "It's a criminal matter." When he heard that, Reuben knew right away what it was. As Yale, as an activist with Students for a Democratic Society, he had been arrested several times in connection with protests over the Vietnam War. He had an FBI file. Half a century later, he could hold a top-secret clearance, but could not walk around the White House without an escort. Eventually, the Secret Service agreed to waive their policy in his case. The cabinet principals approved the Reuben Kalenda strategy paper for renewed negotiations with the Taliban on November 30, 2012. Around the same time, through Sheikh Faisal and the Qatari government, the Conflict Resolution Cell revived their confidence-building plan to break the deadlock with Tayyip Aga. They returned to the idea that opening the Taliban's political office in Qatar would provide a visible, practical springboard to negotiations, a new atmosphere for diplomacy. The two sides could move on the prisoner exchange plan from there. Earlier, they had tried to resolve all the issues in advance. Now they would concentrate on opening the office and then negotiate about prisoners. To try that, however, they would have to persuade Hamid Karzai to drop the poison pill objections he had made, such as his demand that the Taliban talk to his government first. The Obama administration invited Karzai to Washington for a state visit in January. The visible purpose was to try to coax Karzai into a security agreement that would allow American forces to remain in Afghanistan after 2014. In private, they also worked to move Karzai off his blocking position. After Karzai and his senior aides settled in at Blair House, National Security Advisor Tom Donilon summoned them to the Situation Room. Lute introduced an intelligence briefing on how the United States saw its future in Afghanistan. The briefing made a factual case that the Taliban were essentially self-sufficient, indigenous, had no meaningful connection to Al-Qaeda, and were not owned and operated by ISI. The latter finding was a matter of emphasis. Even if Directorate S did not run the Taliban's war, was it not culpable for the sanctuary the Taliban leadership enjoyed on Pakistani soil? As Mark Grossman once put it to Kayani during this period, they're not called the Milwaukee Shura. Still, the briefing challenged Karzai's bedrock belief that his country would not be at war if it weren't for Directorate S and ISI. The Afghans erupted into conversation in Dari and Pashto, evidently shocked by the assessment. Later, Lute explained to Karzai what the intelligence analysis implied about the American mission in Afghanistan after the end of NATO-led combat in 2014. The United States would stay on to fight Al-Qaeda, not the Taliban. The war against the Taliban, or negotiations to settle the war against the Taliban, would belong to the Afghan government and its security forces, with international subsidies, training, and assistance. It seemed evident to the Americans that this had been the plan all along. But again, Karzai seemed shocked and disoriented. He had never accepted that the Taliban constituted an internal insurgency against his government. In his analysis, they were ISI's proxy force, mysteriously tolerated by Washington. The Obama administration and Karzai were bound by enormous sacrifices in expenditure and blood, and yet they saw the war in fundamentally different terms. In their one-on-one, Obama urged Karzai to support a restart of the talks with Tayyip Aga, to drop the poison pill terms that had killed the negotiations a year earlier. "We need to get past this deadlock," Obama said. He asked Karzai to relent on his condition that the Taliban meet with the Afghan government first. "Also," the president went on, "they needed to move forward with Qatar. The emirate provided the most credible channel for negotiations. Everybody involved in this, Karzai, the Pakistanis, and American intelligence, assessed that Tayyip Aga was the real deal," Obama said. "Let's not mess around with another mediator," he urged. Karzai said he was open to compromise. His aides worked to develop a joint statement by Karzai and Obama that would carefully describe the Taliban's prospective office as being for negotiations, a form of permission for the office granted by Karzai. The statement said Obama and Karzai would support an office in Doha for the purpose of negotiations between Karzai's High Peace Council and the authorized representatives of the Taliban. Qatar then issued its own statement, calling on the armed opposition to join a political process so the Taliban could say that it was their concession. Over dinner with Hillary Clinton, who was in her last weeks at the State Department, Karzai agreed that this would be adequate. The idea was for the Taliban to have a legitimate political address for the first time since 2001 in just a matter of weeks. Obama had moved Karzai, at least temporarily, but the Afghan president remained thoroughly estranged. "You've failed," Karzai told Zalmay Khalilzad over dinner one night late in 2012, referring to the United States. Karzai could sound despondent and threatening at the same time. "Everything will collapse. The army is rubbish. The government is a puppet, and nobody can hold elections in this country. The Americans did not let me come to an agreement with the Taliban, but I can tell you, I can come to an agreement." The CIA and other quarters of the intelligence community continued to circulate classified analysis of Karzai's mindset. The best-informed takes on Karzai accounted for his understandable fears and grievances, as well as his misguided fantasies about American designs on South and Central Asia. Prohibited by the Afghan constitution from seeking re-election, Karzai sought to remain relevant and influential as the 2014 vote to choose his successor neared. Being disruptive was one way to do that. It was also plain from Karzai's remarks in public and private that, like many political leaders nearing the end of their time in power, he was concerned about his legacy in Afghan history. He was obviously determined to avoid being remembered as an American quisling. Moreover, Karzai believed what he said about the damage done by the American military's home invasions and battlefield mistakes. Yet his theatrical, emotional remarks over the last few years had left Obama and his aides increasingly jaundiced, beyond frustrated. Karzai was not the only one in this relationship who took things personally. James Dobbins was 70 years old when Secretary of State John Kerry asked him to become the special envoy early in 2013. Dobbins had worked on the Vietnam peace talks as a young diplomat. He supported the Obama administration's outreach to Tayyip Aga, but had constrained expectations about how quickly it might produce results. On Karzai, his advice was to wait him out and not become too aggravated. It seemed clear to Dobbins that a majority of the Afghan political class, including all of Karzai's most likely successors, wanted to reach an agreement that would keep some American forces in the country after 2014. If Karzai chose not to sign a deal, his successor would. Because Karzai believed that the United States could make Pakistan do whatever it wanted, and that the ISI could turn off the Taliban's insurgency effortlessly, Their combined failure to act still seemed to him evidence of malign American intent. He seemed to countenance a theory that the United States was deliberately promoting violent instability in the region in order to control Afghanistan or to make things difficult for Iran and China. Mr. President, between Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks, you have several million documents to examine. Can you find any mention of such designs? Dobbins said. Do you really think I would lie to you about this? Maybe you don't know about the plan, Karzai replied. He referred to there being a deep state in America. Mr. President, there is no deep state, Dobbins insisted. Chuck Hagel, who became Secretary of Defense early in 2013, had a history with Karzai dating to the Bush administration. Hagel flew to Kabul on his first trip abroad as Defense Secretary. Karzai marked his arrival by issuing public invective, asserting that America was aligned with the Taliban to destabilize Afghanistan. Karzai tried to put off meeting Hagel, but eventually agreed to see him one-on-one at the palace. Mr. President, this has to stop, Hagel told him. You may have John McCain and Lindsey Graham and a few senators who will be with you to the end, but that's not where Congress is. That's not where the American people are. If you keep screwing around with this, you're going to find yourself way out alone, because this president will pull the plug on you and the Congress will too. This country has a belly full of you. How do you think this plays out in the American press? Hagel went on. We've got kids out here dying. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars, kids coming back with no legs. And then the blaring headlines are, Karzai accuses us of being traitors. Karzai rarely took the bait in these sorts of conversations. The words just seemed to wash over him. I understand, Mr. Secretary. You and I have known each other a long time. I value what you're telling me. Because it played into Karzai's paranoia, or as Karzai might say, confirmed his analysis, the Americans concealed the extent of their collaboration with Kayani after the smoke-filled room sessions at Army House. Early in 2013, the Qataris worked with the Taliban political leadership to assure the guerrillas that the American desire to revive negotiations with them was legitimate, and that, despite the previous failures, the Obama administration was serious and would support the opening of a political office in Qatar soon. As for Kayani and ISI, the Americans could never quite tell what they were doing with the Taliban leadership. Kayani continued to repeat his contact but not control mantra, and the White House did not initially ask him to take action. The fragmentary evidence available reinforced the impression Tayyip Aga gave that he was hostile to ISI. At one point, the Americans learned that ISI had detained members of the Taliban envoy's family in Pakistan and threatened the negotiator if he chose to return to Pakistan. Although they made no public announcement, the Taliban agreed to return to the talks. There ensued weeks of work on two draft documents. One was called the Office MOU, or Memorandum of Understanding. The draft provided that the Taliban could not command or control the insurgency in Afghanistan from the Qatar office. Another provision held that they could not issue propaganda from there. A third was that they could not conduct fundraising. The Qatari government would finance the office with no outside contributions, and the money would be monitored by Qatar. Also, the MOU said, the Taliban could not call the office an outpost or embassy of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, as they had named their government while in power during the 1990s. Lute's team came up with a name that the Americans, and later Karzai, felt was acceptable. The Political Office of the Afghan Taliban. The Taliban representatives stationed there could meet with other diplomats, Europeans, non-governmental agencies working in Afghanistan, the United Nations. The MOU was to be signed by President Obama and the Emir of Qatar. But the Qataris would not go forward unless the Taliban agreed to the final terms. British and Norwegian envoys continued to meet with Tayyip Aga, so they worked as well on bridging the last gaps. All along, the idea had been that the Taliban would issue a public statement when the office in Qatar opened, repudiating al-Qaeda and terrorism in some fashion. In Washington, Jeff Hayes went back through recent aid statements issued in the name of Mullah Muhammad Omar. He essentially copied and pasted language previously issued by the Taliban into a single draft statement for the Taliban to issue on the big day. "This sounds like fourth grade English," as one American participant put it. "This isn't the Marshall Plan." British Prime Minister David Cameron, who was collaborating with Obama on the negotiation, had hosted Karzai and Kayani at Chequers, his country residence, to encourage them to support reconciliation. On April 23, 2013, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, also hosted Karzai and Kayani at Truman Hall, the 27-acre residence of the U.S. ambassador to NATO in Brussels. They set up a U-shaped table in the ambassador's living room, looking out on his gardens. Kerry, Karzai, and Kayani took a walk together on the wooded grounds. During the summit, Lute handed Kayani a copy of the draft statement for the Taliban that Hayes had prepared. Kayani had now achieved the position that ISI had always said it sought, negotiating agent for the Taliban. Kayani insisted that he did not know where Mullah Muhammad Omar was. More than 2 years later, the Taliban would admit that on the very day Kayani, Karzai, and Kerry met in Brussels, Omar died of tuberculosis in a Karachi hospital. If Kayani knew of the Taliban emir's dire condition, he kept it to himself while working on the statement in Omar's name. None of the Americans involved had a clue. Kayani continued to represent to the Americans that he was carrying messages from Omar. Afghan intelligence did have a sense that Omar might be dead, but it could not prove it to the satisfaction of the Americans. The National Directorate of Security had developed a source with access to a wife of Mullah Omar's. The wife reportedly traveled to Karachi for conjugal visits with her husband every few months. That spring, the source reported that on the wife's regular visit, she had not been able to see him and had gleaned that he had died. But this was a single source, reporting hearsay from an agent that nobody had vetted. The effort to finalize all the documents for the Qatar grand opening proved to be a grind. They went around and around about the office MOU. Karzai remained sensitive about any form of agreement that would appear to elevate the Taliban to a status equivalent to that of his elected government. They finally decided to abandon the memorandum and replace it with a series of letters. The Qatari government would write a diplomatic note, encompassing the previously agreed terms of the MOU, addressed to the State Department, assuring the United States that the rules would be followed. And Obama would write a letter to Karzai, essentially offering his own guarantee. No command and control, no fundraising, and the outpost would be called the Political Office of the Afghan Taliban. Obama also telephoned the Emir of Qatar to cement the understanding. It was questionable how firmly these documents bound the Taliban to terms. The grand opening was scheduled for June. The average daytime high temperature in Qatar during June well exceeds 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Doha sinks into a shimmering torpor. To oversee the preparations, Jeff Hayes, Jarrett Blank, a deputy to Dobbins, and Barney Rubin flew to Qatar. There were more delays. Rubin and Blank left before the opening. At last, it was agreed to debut the office on June 18th. A few nights before, a CIA-NSA team of black bag specialists broke into the Taliban office compound in Doha to plant listening devices. These were offshore specialists who came and went from break-in jobs around the world, focused only on the narrow task assigned them. Once inside, the team members saw firsthand all the preparations the Taliban had made for the grand opening. But they were not briefed on what agreements had been made about the movement's presentation. The team did its work and reported nothing amiss. Opening day, the conflict resolution cell learned that Al Jazeera was planning live coverage of a debut press conference given by the Taliban at the new office. Lute watched the broadcast in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. At the State Department, in the Special Envoy's ground floor suite, someone had bought champagne. Years of work, long days, endless flights, and hundreds of memos and meetings had finally produced a diplomatic breakthrough that might yet reduce Afghanistan's violence and end some of its suffering. Al Jazeera's anchor cut to the scene. The screen showed a giant sign behind the speaker's podium that read, "Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan." Out front of the building, the broadcast showed, was a flagpole. It flew the former black-and-white flag of the Islamic Emirate high above the compound's wall. "Fuck," Lute announced. The Taliban had blatantly violated terms Obama had guaranteed to Karzai. The Afghan president reacted furiously and quickly. He announced his withdrawal from the American negotiation effort. Later, in public, he waved around the guarantee letter Obama had sent him to illustrate that no guarantee of the United States could ever be trusted. After a round of phone calls, threats, and pleadings, the Taliban removed their Islamic Emirate sign. Reuben was flying back to Qatar. When he landed in Doha, his BlackBerry scrolled one panicked message after another. The Americans told the Taliban they had to remove their flag and sign permanently if they wanted to keep the office. The Taliban signaled that they'd rather close it down. Lute sent Reuben over to the Taliban office several days in a row to document whether the Taliban had pulled down the flag and sign. At first it turned out that they kept raising their prohibited Islamic Emirate flag in the morning, but only to half-mast, so that it could not be seen outside the high walls of the compound. It did not take long for the conflict resolution cell to accept that the fiasco was irreversible and that the negotiations they had met on biweekly for 3 years were dead. They had too many other issues with Karzai, particularly around the continuing security presence in Afghanistan after 2014, to play this losing hand any longer. John Kerry called Karzai and apologized. The United States would not recognize the political office as planned. The Doha office failure was an episode of remarkable diplomatic incompetence. The decision to replace the office MOU with letters had created too much ambiguity. The Americans mainly blamed Sheikh Faisal. They suspected he had told the Taliban they could call themselves whatever they wanted, without focusing on where that would leave the Obama administration and Karzai. A deputy foreign minister of Qatar stood at the podium in front of the giant prohibited sign at the debut press conference. At the State Department, a senior career foreign officer told colleagues, "The Qataris fucked up every mediation they've been involved with. What made us think this would be any different?" For others who had given years to the project, the causes of the failure seemed to lie closer to home. How could the most powerful government on Earth, with tens of thousands of troops at war, at a pivotal moment of negotiations aimed at exiting the war, mess up so badly? How could it be that a scholar on contract with the State Department, an aide to a State Department envoy, and a DIA analyst constituted the entire on-the-ground effort to make sure a complicated, vitally important agreement hit the mark at the moment of its announcement? Where was the U.S. Embassy? Where was the CIA? It was so much the amateur hour, Keystone Cops, as a participant in the effort put it. It was just terrible. Terrible. This is the United States. This is what we do? Kayani, too, was stunned at the ineptitude. The message from many of the Pakistanis who had entered the negotiations after the Army House sessions was simple. How could you guys fuck this up so bad? For their part, the Taliban had started out believing, insisting again and again, that the United States was an indispensable party to any negotiation. After June, they shifted toward thinking that the United States was an utterly incompetent obstacle to anything they might want to achieve, as the American participant put it. At the end of 2013, Rob Williams, the National Intelligence Officer for South Asia, oversaw another national intelligence estimate about the Afghan war. It examined several scenarios and found that the level of international support would be the biggest factor determining the future of the Kabul government. If there were no international troops and no international aid available, the regime would likely collapse quickly. One way to interpret the NIE was that the NATO troop surge had bought a decent interval before the Afghan government fell under the Taliban's pressure. But unless the United States or its allies was prepared to make a decades-long South Korea-like commitment to Afghanistan's security, it had bought little more than that. Looking ahead, there was no way that the Kabul regime would be able to pay on its own for the Afghan National Army and police. This meant any forecast of the durability of the Afghan forces had to account for the willingness of Congress, European governments, Japan, and others to write large checks to subsidize Kabul indefinitely. At the CIA, officers like Chris Wood, who had been working in the country since the fall of 2001, told colleagues that they were confident the Taliban would be back in power by 2017. The Afghan forces were being asked to take charge of their war very rapidly. At the beginning of 2013, there were about 100,000 international troops in the International Security Assistance Force for Afghanistan. Of those, 68,000 were American, 9,000 were British, 4,400 were German, 3,000 were Italian, and almost 2,000 were Polish. A year later, the total international force had shrunk to about 57,000, with 38,000 troops from the United States. The force was on a fast glide path to less than 20,000 international soldiers. The national intelligence estimate pointed out that when the Soviet Union withdrew from its Afghan war in the late 1980s, Moscow was able to hold off the CIA-backed Mujahideen rebels by pouring in subsidies to its client government in Kabul, which was led by former communists. The numbers were admittedly squishy, but the Soviets poured in between $3 billion and $6 billion annually in 2011 dollars, the analysis estimated. But Moscow did not have an independently elected Congress to worry about, and could print money at will. And the Soviets were willing to provide an enormous amount of equipment by land and air. The estimate raised doubts about the comparable durability of NATO and American commitments to Karzai's successor. In the short term, the NIE forecast, the Taliban would gain more territory in the countryside. About the major controversy of the war, the role of ISI, it found that to bring the Taliban to heel, it would be necessary to do something at last about the movement's safe havens in Pakistan. But the analysis also held that the sanctuaries were not the only cause of the Taliban's revival. The movement had its own political objectives, restoration of the Islamic Emirate, that it pursued by guerrilla and terrorist violence without reference to Pakistan. CIA analysts had taken a dark view of Afghanistan's prospects for years now. They had been equally confident in 1989 that the Soviet-backed government in Kabul would collapse quickly, and that analysis had proved wrong. President Najibullah's regime fell only after the Soviet Union itself dissolved and its subsidies collapsed abruptly. James Dobbins was accustomed to reading predictions of doom from his intelligence counterparts. He knew they weren't always right. Afghanistan was not the same country it had been in 1989 or 2001. In the decades since the Taliban's fall, it had undergone rapid urbanization, and there was a new anti-Taliban generation in the cities that enjoyed connectivity to the world and rising literacy rates. He thought it was hard to say how Afghan elites and networks would perform after the withdrawal of the large international military force, although he agreed with the NIE's forecast that a rapid and complete withdrawal might lead to the collapse of Karzai's government. The willingness of Congress and NATO governments to subsidize Kabul adequately was an uncertainty, but it was not a given they would withdraw substantial aid quickly, he argued. The debacle at Doha left Dobbins and Lute to turn to the forthcoming Afghan presidential election to try to manage the risks of a failed transition at the Arg Palace. Now that he had been proven right about the American talks with the Taliban, Karzai went back to probing for negotiations with the Taliban on his own. In September 2013, Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif released from prison Mullah Baradar, the longtime Taliban number two. The Karzai family had long pointed to Baradar as a potential Taliban peacemaker, but it wasn't clear that this hope had any basis in fact. There were intelligence reports that while in ISI custody, Baradar had suffered a stroke and had become reticent, or that he had stopped taking important medication, or that he had taken too much medication. At least one official who read the reports thought that perhaps Baradar, fearful that he would be forced into talks with Karzai's government, which he still rejected as illegitimate, had somehow figured out a way to become silent. Like Mullah Muhammad Omar's health condition, here was another Taliban mystery inside a mystery, shrouded by ISI. With the Obama administration, Karzai continued to thrash about, refusing to sign an agreement that would allow U.S. forces to remain. The White House leaked word to the press that it might preempt Karzai by adopting a zero option, a complete pullout of all American forces. At one point during this back and forth, early in 2014, Karzai telephoned Zalmay Khalilzad from Kabul to talk about the issue. Karzai was in broadcast mode, meaning that he knew his phone was being listened to by diverse intelligence agencies. He spoke with those audiences in mind. "You should think about the implications if the U.S. decides to go for the zero option," Khalilzad told him, "not only for the current generations of Afghans and for all that has been accomplished, but for future generations. Once in a while, you are confronted with big decisions, and this is perhaps the biggest decision facing Afghanistan since the Soviet departure." Karzai said that if the United States continued to conduct military operations in which innocent Afghans died, it is better that they leave than that they stay. They are in bed with Pakistan, and they won't restart a peace process, which they could easily do. If they leave, then we will have to deal with Pakistan ourselves as to what to do. "Look," Khalilzad said, "if you wanted to show that you are not a lackey of the United States, you have accomplished that. That box has been checked. Now one has to think about the future of 30 million Afghans, as well as future generations. If it all unravels, who knows when it can be brought back together again? You have to think of your responsibility to this, to the people, and to future generations." "I am very much at peace for the first time," Karzai answered. "I am more at peace than I have ever been, because I know this is the right thing to do. Either America stays in a different way, or it leaves. If the U.S. leaves, I can explain it to the Afghan people, and they will understand." Chapter 35. Coup d'État. Rahmatullah Nabil first took charge of Afghan intelligence in 2010, after Hamid Karzai forced the resignation of Amrullah Saleh, amid Karzai's flirtations with ISI. Nabil was not connected to any of the major armed factions from the eras of the Soviet occupation and the subsequent civil war. Before the Taliban's fall, he had worked for a decade in Kabul for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees as a manager. He remained at the UN after Karzai took power until 2003, when he joined the staff of the new National Security Council at the Arg Palace. Soon, Karzai appointed him to supervise his bodyguards and palace protection service, akin to the United States Secret Service. The job required coordination with the CIA, the State Department, European Security Services, and private contractors. Karzai and his closest advisors wanted a capable manager who was also a reliable Pashtun. Nabil gradually became a trusted member of Karzai's inner circle, and watched up close as the president struggled with the pressures of office and became alienated from the United States. When Karzai removed Amrullah Saleh, he initially appointed another personal confidant, Ibrahim Spinzada, as acting director of NDS. But he did not want the job permanently. Karzai summoned Nabil to the palace. "What do you think if I send you to NDS?" he asked. Nabil had the leadership experience to do the job, he believed, and he said that he would work honestly. "But the biggest problem is, I don't have any political support." NDS officers knew the secrets of powerful politicians and gunmen. They tapped phones. They monitored coup plots and other security threats. The legacy of KGB training and Panjshiri patronage at NDS that had grown up under Engineer Arif and then Amrullah Saleh, both aides to Ahmad Shah Massoud, would be difficult for a Pashtun technocrat to take on, and Nabil had no network of his own to call upon. Yet Karzai insisted. When Nabil moved into Amrullah Saleh's office that summer, he noticed a framed photograph of Hamid Karzai on the wall, and beside it, markings that indicated a second picture had been removed. He asked what had been there. It was a photograph of Commander Massoud, one of his new aides explained. Saleh had taken it with him when he departed. Nabil ordered another photo of Massoud mounted in its place. It was going to be difficult to persuade his colleagues that he aspired to be a post-ethnic Afghan patriot, but he had to start somewhere. Gradually, Nabil educated himself about the secrets he had inherited. He learned about the source networks Saleh had built to watch the Taliban, particularly across the border in Pakistan. One of the most sensitive operations involved the Pakistani Taliban. After CIA drone missiles killed Baitullah Massoud, the founder of the movement, his brother Hakimullah had succeeded him as emir. During 2009, under Hakimullah's spur, the Pakistani Taliban entered into a full-blown revolutionary war against the Pakistani state, often including its intelligence wing, ISI. The National Directorate of Security was also in a full-blown war against the ISI. Under the old adage, "the enemy of my enemy is my friend," there seemed scope for Afghan intelligence to cooperate with the Pakistani Taliban. At first, NDS developed sources in the movement only for intelligence collection, Nabil learned. The Pakistani Taliban were present throughout Waziristan, so Massoud tribal sources could offer helpful information. Hakimullah Massoud later sent a deputy, Latif Ullah Massoud, to Kabul to deepen cooperation. For their part, ISI officers repeatedly told American counterparts that Pakistani Taliban commanders were agents of India and NDS. The Americans often discounted these claims. With reason, they saw the movement as blowback from the Pakistan's army long suckering of militancy. In any event, while it was not clear what role, if any, India had in Nabil's operation with the Massouds, the NDS director and his senior officers had no qualms about signaling to Pakistan that they could always do to Pakistan what ISI did to Afghanistan, even if they had to work with murderous figures like the Massoud leaders. In the summer of 2012, Hamid Karzai informed Nabil that he had decided that NDS directors should limit their service to 2 years. This would prevent spy chiefs from becoming too powerful. Nabil accepted the decision. Karzai appointed Asadullah Khalid, the longtime CIA ally, as his successor. Khalid had overseen torture and rough detention for a decade in various posts, going back to his tour as governor of Ghazni province in 2002, according to various published reports. He had diverse enemies. In December, a suicide bomber met him at a guest house in Kabul and detonated his explosives. Khalid was seriously wounded, but survived. The NDS eventually concluded that the attack stemmed from a long-term dispute with an Afghan family dating to Khalid's service as governor in Ghazni. Hamid Karzai was reluctant to remove Khalid from NDS leadership while he recovered from his wounds, but by the summer of 2013, the lack of active leadership at the service had become a problem. Even healthy, Khalid remained a rough, one-man band, as the American embassy had once described him. The Afghan security forces were preparing in late 2013 to take charge of the war from NATO. Preparations had started for a presidential election in 2014 that would inevitably take place in the midst of violence. NDS needed a devoted, round-the-clock leader. Eventually, Karzai asked Nabil to return as acting director. After the fiasco concerning the Taliban's political office in Qatar, the Obama administration essentially abandoned peace negotiations with the enemy and turned attention to a different field of Afghan politics, the election contest to succeed Hamid Karzai. In October, the Afghan government announced 11 candidates who had qualified to run for president. These included three Pashtuns who had served Karzai at the ARG. Two of them were technocrats who had returned to Afghanistan from the West after 2001 and had worked as ministers, Zalmay Rasool and Ashraf Ghani. The third was Gul Aga Sherzai, the Barakzai strongman. Also in the field was the runner-up from 2009, Abdullah Abdullah, the eye doctor who had been close to Ahmad Shah Massoud. Abdullah had swallowed his ire about electoral fraud in 2009, in the hope that his time would come in 2014. Yet the persistence of ethnic divisions among Afghanistan's elites meant that Abdullah, who was of mixed family heritage but was identified with the Northern Alliance, would inevitably face a Pashtun rival. The question was whether this rival would be Rasool, Ghani, or Sherzai. Hamid Karzai had been re-elected in 2009, while his network of Pashtun supporters in the war-ravaged South rigged ballot boxes there. The problems that had given rise to fraud in 2009 had not been solved since then. Election supervisors were politicized and allied with Karzai. The systems to prevent fraud schemes from the process of voter registration right through to counting ballots remained vulnerable. And the map of Afghanistan's violence meant that voters in Pashtun areas, where the Taliban had the greatest influence, would have more trouble getting to the polls than citizens in non-Pashtun areas. During 2009, violence and voter alienation produced turnout rates of 10% or less in some districts of Kandahar and Helmand. The likelihood that this would be repeated in 2014 provided a motivation for Pashtun leaders to embrace fraud schemes to counterbalance the problems of Pashtun access to the polls. It seemed obvious that Karzai, or his network, could mobilize a fraud campaign similar to the one carried out in 2009 on behalf of any successor Karzai designated. Skillfully, late in 2013 and into 2014, Karzai withheld his endorsement. He stated that he planned to leave politics and retire in Kabul after his successor's election, but Afghan politicians took it for granted that Karzai would remain active and influential, not least to protect his family's interests and his own. This logic suggested that the final choice would come down to Rasool or Ghani. Karzai had pushed Gul Aga Sherzai out of the race in 2009, and he remained a wild card, an independent power. Karzai hinted to numerous visitors that he would back Rasool, and several candidates who dropped out early in 2014 endorsed Rasool. But in the end, Karzai appeared to shift his support to Ghani. On April 5, 2014, millions of Afghans cast their ballots. Election officials reported 6.6 million votes, a turnout better than in 2009, yet well below 50%, even before accounting for the likelihood that, as in 2009, a million or more votes were fraudulent. Abdullah won 45%, just under the 50 plus 1% he required to avoid a second round of voting. Ghani finished second with 31%. Rasool was third with 11%. Abdullah had reason to be encouraged. Although he drew his greatest support from Tajik and Hazara areas, the distribution of his votes showed that he had national, cross-ethnic appeal. Yet Pashtun voters had split their support among several candidates. In the second round, if they united around Ghani, the remaining Pashtun candidate, they might overtake Abdullah's advantage. At NDS, after receiving tips about wrongdoing, Nabil's intelligence officers listened to the telephone conversations and monitored the text messages of the election's supervisors and those of powerful Afghan politicians. The intelligence officers could clearly hear these election officials and politicians organizing fraud on a large scale. Nabil brought the evidence to Karzai. The president told him to eavesdrop further, to document what Karzai assumed to be an American conspiracy to interfere with the vote. Karzai didn't know what Washington was trying to accomplish with its intrigues, but after his experience with Holbrook and other officials in 2009, he readily assumed that the Obama administration was manipulating Afghan politics. Karzai wanted to know how the U.S. is interfering, whom they are contacting, who is contacting them, and what they are saying. When NDS officers tapped the phone of Ziaul Haq Amarkel, the secretary of the Independent Election Commission, which was supposed to organize a clean vote, the officers heard him talking not to American diplomats, but to colleagues in various provinces, apparently instructing them to organize fraud at Abdullah's expense, as Nabil interpreted it. In one conversation, Amarkel allegedly told provincial officials to take sheep to the mountains, stuff them, and bring them back, which NDS interpreted as code for ballot stuffing. Later, police found Amarkel traveling with thousands of blank election ballots. Nabil worried that if the election collapsed amid fraud allegations, Karzai would blame him and NDS for not warning him. At a National Security Council meeting, Nabil decided to show his hand. "Mr. President," he said in front of Karzai and aides, "I have almost 5,000 SIGINT conversations on file of election officials and allies that show patterns of fraud." Karzai asked for specifics. Nabil retrieved a dozen audio files and transcripts as examples. Karzai seemed to worry about whether Nabil might be part of the American conspiracy that he perceived. In any event, he told the NDS director to take his evidence to Amarkel's boss, Ahmad Yusuf Nuristani, the chief of the Independent Election Commission. But the matter stalled. Finally, a Tajik NDS officer involved in the eavesdropping, deeply offended by the ethnic slurs he overheard, decided to act on his own. He copied some of the evidence and leaked it to Abdullah. On June 14th, Afghans voted in the second round. 4 days later, Abdullah went public with his fraud evidence and demanded that the Independent Election Commission stop counting votes. He withdrew his observers from the vote-counting process. Amarkel resigned, without admitting wrongdoing, but that decision was not enough to settle the matter. "From today onward, we reject all the decisions and activities of the Independent Election Commission," Abdullah announced. "They have no intention to assess the fraudulent votes and separate the dirty votes from the clean votes." Abdullah's rejection of the constitutional process carried an unsubtle warning that his northern backers might seize power in Kabul by force. The campaign devolved day by day toward the incitement of a new round of ethnic civil war, a rerun of the 1990s. Former allies of Ahmad Shah Massoud aligned with Abdullah stoked the flames. Amrullah Saleh publicly called the Independent Election Commission and the Election Complaints Commission biased, racist, corrupt. Atta Mohammed Noor, the governor of Balkh province, and perhaps the most powerful officeholder in Abdullah's camp, prepared to declare our own legitimate government led by Abdullah. Facebook and other social media platforms became cauldrons of ethnic slander. Germany warned NATO allies that Abdullah's supporters intended to violently seize government centers in several provinces, and that they might then march on the Arg Palace to occupy it by force. After 13 years, the loss of more than 1,000 lives, and the expenditure of unfathomable sums of money, the entire American project in Afghanistan looked as if it might terminate in a coup d'état, followed by civil war. President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry telephoned Abdullah to urge him to stand down and to wait for Kerry to fly to Kabul to try to sort out a peaceful solution. Kerry issued a public statement warning that any action to take power by extra-legal means will cost Afghanistan the financial and security support of the United States and the international community. Jan Kubisch, the United Nations envoy to Afghanistan, negotiated with Ghani and Abdullah on a plan to audit suspicious votes. Kerry landed on July 11th. The next night, after whirlwind negotiations at the American embassy, Kerry stood between the two contenders at a press conference as they announced agreement on a new vote-counting plan. They also announced a vague plan to share power in a unity government after the count was completed. Kerry's band-aid diplomacy barely stuck. The two sides squabbled over the vote-counting process. In mid-August, Governor Noor announced that he would not accept any result short of Abdullah's victory and vowed to lead a civil uprising if the recount did not ratify Abdullah's election. The CIA quietly arranged, through former officers close to him, for Amrullah Saleh to visit the United States with his family, a cooling-off period during which Saleh could give some private seminars. But the Afghan government continued to crack from within. Nabil was among those who feared civil war remained imminent. There were posters in Tajik areas of Kabul declaring Abdullah president. Commanders mobilized armed militias openly in the capital. Nabil assured the American embassy that he would try to keep NDS neutral. He wondered how his service might defend the government from violent collapse if Abdullah's supporters attempted a coup or if Ghani tried to preempt Abdullah's supporters violently. Nabil, Ranjing Spanta, the National Security Advisor, Bismillah Khan, the Minister of Defense, and Umar Daudzai, the Minister of Interior, discussed the situation. They drafted a statement and discussed holding a press conference where they would declare an interim government to buy time for the election mess to be sorted out peacefully. Their main concern was to prevent the Afghan army or other security forces from allowing anyone to interfere with the election or push the country toward chaos. Of course, the quartet's intervention would be a kind of coup d'etat as well. Yet, if they acted together, they might present a powerful, stabilizing, multi-ethnic group of technocrats who favored a peaceful resolution. The current head of the military, the head of the police, the head of intelligence, and the government's senior national security advisor. They agreed that they would not act yet, but would prepare a statement and proceed only if the situation is getting out of hand, as Nabil put it, in which case they would call on people that we should save our country. As a kind of warning shot, some in the group talked about their plan with Matthew Rosenberg, a reporter for the New York Times. A coterie of powerful Afghan government ministers and officials with strong ties to the security forces are threatening to seize power if an election impasse that has paralyzed the country is not resolved soon, Rosenberg wrote on August 18th. Furious, Karzai expelled Rosenberg from the country, informing him that he had been declared a spy with secret relations. Police escorted the journalist onto a plane. ISAF's new commanding general, Joseph Dunford, warned the quartet that if they followed through on their plan, the United States would treat them no differently than the Taliban, as enemies of the state. Day after day, in 4 prefabricated warehouses off the highway from Kabul to Jalalabad, the Independent Election Commission oversaw the ballot audit Kerry had negotiated. Ballot boxes stacked 6 high lined the walls of the Quonset huts. At long plastic tables sat observers from the Abdullah campaign, the Ghani campaign, the international community, and Afghanistan's Independent Election Commission. Each plastic box of ballots had a sticker on it indicating its origins. The ballots themselves were blue, 4 inches by 5 inches, with pictures of the candidates and the visual symbols they had chosen to represent them in a still largely